Hello and a warm welcome. I am Armin Trost, professor for organizational behavior at the Furtwangen University in Germany, and this is my course on social research methods. So, welcome back, everybody. In this episode, we're going to talk about research design. That's a completely different thing compared to what we have done in the last episodes. In the last episodes, we were talking about how you collect data using a questionnaire, doing observation, doing content analysis, or the like. The research design is much more about, you can put it like, it's about the architecture of the study. Right? So that sounds a little bit weird now. Let me maybe have a very simple example that I will use throughout this entire episode, and we can use this example that I have just pulled from the air spontaneously. We can use this to make things clear. I pulled a very simple example, and let's assume there is the hypothesis that money affects happiness. Okay. That's simple. We have maybe the assumption that the more money you have, the happier you are, right? Okay, now we can have a long philosophical discussion. No, money does not make happy. Yeah, and there are thousands of reasons why we believe that money does not make happy. And there are millions of very wealthy people who are not happy. But you know, there are a lot of very poor people who are not happy either. And it's not so easy. So, stop the debate. We do a study. Okay, we do a simple study. And now the question is, how do you do this? So, to get back to our original idea of how to define a hypothesis, now we see two variables, right? We see money, and we can also say wealth. And the other is happiness. Money, I stick to the term money, even though it does not sound too scientific. Money is the independent variable. It's considered as the cause, and happiness is the dependent variable. That's the effect. Money affects happiness. Independent variable, dependent variable. You got this straight, okay? Remember this, please. Independent variable, dependent variable. So, when we do this study, we have to consider both. Right? I mean, that makes sense. We cannot do a study about money affecting happiness without considering one or both. Right? So we have to consider both. But how do we consider both? How do we do this? And my main focus now lies with the independent variable, with the money. Okay? Because here we now can do a lot of different things when doing a study. Happiness, let's make that short. Let's assume we simply measure this by using a questionnaire, okay? We could also do content analysis, asking people writing an essay, and then we look how happy that sounds, maybe. We can even make images of people, and then we analyze the content of the images, maybe. We can do this, but we don't do this. We can have a test. That is something that we do. A happiness test. That would be nice. Yeah? Happiness test. No, we use a very simple technique. We ask the people on a scale from 0 to 10, how happy are you? And we do this as part of a questionnaire. In a real study, you would do that differently, okay? But for the sake of simplicity, let's assume we simply do it that way. Okay, so now that's the dependent variable. That's all fine. The interesting thing is, what do we do with the independent variable, with money? And now, the first thing is, we can do two things now. Right? Two things. And now that's very important. We can either just measure the money you have in your pocket or the subjects have in their pocket as it is currently. Right? So you could just go out and say, okay, I want to ask people, how much money do you earn in a month? how much money do you have readily available? So it's about the liquidity. And then we ask the question, how happy are you? So we measure as things are. And then we simply analyze, is there a correlation, maybe something like this. Okay, this is something that we could do. That's simple. So in that case, we do not manipulate the money. We simply measure it. We compare different groups, so to speak. So we ask the people, how much money do you have in your pocket, right? And now you compare different groups. Let's say you have the poor ones, the medium people, and the rich people. Right? Based on their response, we compare these different groups, right? So, and when we compare these different groups, we now can look at the happiness level, and then we would assume that the poor ones have a different level of happiness than the rich ones. So, and this is what we name a cross-sectional design. We simply compare different groups. That's it, right? We do not manipulate the money they have. We just look at how many money do they have, and then we compare the groups. We compare different groups, right? In that case, we compare different social classes. So that's what we actually are doing, right? So, okay. But maybe you do not compare different groups, you just compare one group, right? So you could do this, for instance, with students. So you look at how things change over time. So you have graduates. Let's say, put it that way, you have graduates. You have students that graduate, and then you measure, and you assume that they get richer over time. So that's the idea. And then we measure happiness once they graduate. And then we measure again after, let's say, 2 years. And then we measure again after 4 years. And then we measure again. And we do this over, let's say, a decade or two. Right. So we compare, we look at one single group over a period of time. And let's say we only look at those who are employed, right? That's the only thing that we do. So and then we look at, okay, how does happiness change over time? Okay, now you might ask, but what is it, money? Okay, we can control this. But whenever you compare one group over the time, one in the same group over time, then we name this a longitudinal study. Longitudinal study, how things change over time. So this idea with money and happiness does not work so well with that one. I know here the question might be more, how does happiness change over time, right? And you look at one and the same group and look how things change over time. You measure again and again and again. Okay, so this is one side, right? Cross-sectional, longitudinal. And the common thing here is that you do not really manipulate your independent variable. You do not change. Now, what does that mean, manipulate? Manipulate would mean the following. And that's practically very difficult with money, maybe. Okay? But maybe we can do this. Let's just imagine it for a moment. We say, okay, we have 100 subjects. 100. So people who take part in our study. And now we do the following. We split this 100 people into, let's say, four different groups. Each group is 25 people. Okay? So the first group, they will receive such kind of money for living. The other, more. And the third one, even more. And the fourth group get the most. Okay? So you have four groups, and four different groups get different levels of money. So now you see, the independent variable, money, now is not just measured how it is, how it appears in the field, in reality. We manipulate this one, right? Actively. Okay, you get so much money, you get so much money, you get so much money, and you get so much money. So we actively change that one. Okay? Now, that sounds a little bit experimentish. Okay? Now, the question now is, when you do this, when you manipulate the independent variable, the first question is there a control group? A control group where you do not do something at all. In that regard, it's a little bit difficult, but you can imagine this with, let's say, a pharmaceutical experiment. So one group, you want to understand, does that substance really heal a certain illness, right? So one group gets the substance and the other group does not get the substance. They get a placebo. So that's the control group. So with one group, you do the so-called experimental treatment, and with the other group, you don't. So do you have something like this? Yes or no? Yeah, okay. Is the assignment of the subjects really random? Is it really that through flipping a coin or whatever, throwing a cube or whatever, do you assign the different subject to the different conditions randomly? Okay, is that the case? Yes, okay, fine. Okay, last question. Is there a double blind method? Double blind means that even the experimenter does not know which subject is in which, not the experimenter, but the real, yeah, the experiment, the real person that operates the experiment does not really know in which condition the different subjects are. This is what we name double blind. If all these three things apply, then you have an experiment. If just one criteria does not apply, then it's only a quasi-experiment. A quasi-experiment, that's a very important term. It's a study which is a kind of experiment. You manipulate the independent variable, but it's not actually a real experiment. Okay, so in practice, very often we have only quasi-experiments. So if that was too fast, I will walk through these different criteria in a minute. But I just wanted to show you that there are some questions that you need to get straight to answer to find out what kind of research design do you actually apply in your study. And you really should know this. So you should not only know that they are all different, and you should only know that these different designs vary in specific kinds, you also should be able to name your own research design in whatever study you are doing. So now let's look at this experiment thing a little bit, okay? And I would like to go into this a little bit more deeper. This was just a kind of starter, a summary in the beginning, okay? So when we talk about experiments or quasi-experiments, there is a kind of way how we articulate the design. And what we always have is observation. We observe the dependent variable. This is what we very often do. In our example, we observe happiness, right? We observe the happiness of people. And we observe the happiness while somehow changing the independent variable through some experimental treatment. This is how we name it, okay? So in our case, we assign different levels of money to different people. We do it actively. That's the experimental treatment. So generally spoken, let's now go a little bit away from our money happiness example. You always try to express your design with simple O and X. And O stands for observation and X stands for experimental treatment. And now you will find a lot of different designs here. And there's a universe of different designs, but I just want to pick out the most important ones. Okay, so one very important design is the so-called pre-test, post-test design. One group only. Okay, again, pre-test, post-test design. What is that? You have an observation of the dependent variable. Then you do something. And then you observe again your dependent variable. So for this case, we again can really apply. We can apply our example of money and happiness. So we have a group of people, let's say 20 people. We measure their happiness. Okay, then we have a happiness, let's say average 6.4. Okay, and then we say, hey, here's money. That's our experimental treatment. You get money. Here, baff, yeah, here's the money. And then after 2 weeks, we measure again. Yeah, and then we might have a happiness level of 7.1. Oh, to decrease. Nice. Money helps. Let's assume it. So we measure one-time happiness, money, experimental treatment, then we measure again. Okay? Pre-test, post-test. In between, we do something. Okay. This is something that we very often find in practice, really. And I would like to go a little bit deeper into this. So here is an example. I once mentioned what a flight risk is, no? Turnover intention. I think that was one in a very early episode. Now let's pull back this topic again. Companies very often see a high turnover rate. What is a turnover rate? A turnover rate is the proportion of people in an organization that over the course of the year voluntarily leave the organization. This is what we name turnover rate. So if you have a turnover rate of, let's say, 10%, then 10 out of 100 employees leave the organization over the course of the year voluntarily. This is your turnover rate. And very often companies want rather have a lower turnover rate, not zero, but rather low, because whenever somebody's leaving the company, you have to replace this person, you have to develop this person, you have to train a new employee, and it's sometimes a whole mess. So now let's assume a turnover rate is pretty high in an organization. Let's say 15, okay? So the company says, oh, we have a problem, high turnover rate, 15%, too. And they see that it's much higher than the industry average. And now the HR director has a cool idea, say, why not giving money to the people, right? Or doing some other intervention. You can do a lot of things to retain people. But let's go the easy way and say, why not paying more? Pay the people more and then they will stay. Okay, so now you do this. You say, guys, salary increase. And now 1 year later, you measure the turnover rate again. And now you see, wow, it's 12. You see? Pre-test, 15. Post-test, 12. Now you see, oh, there's a decrease. There's a decrease, really. Okay. And as an HR director, say, you see, it works. Money works. Really? Can you? No, you can't. You can't. Why not? Because maybe, and we will talk about this so-called threats to internal validity in a few minutes, after we have looked at some experimental designs. Maybe it was not the money. Maybe it was because there was a global recession in the meantime. Maybe there's something else, right? Maybe there's something else. Maybe this 15% was so extremely high that, whenever you have a very extreme result, things drop just through probability. Yeah, this is what we name this was statistical regression. Maybe there's something else. There was this great Hawthorne study. Those who deal with organizational behavior, they know about this study, Hawthorne study, a classic experiment, part of scientific management. The idea was, how is it when you change the light in a factory, does that affect the performance of people? So they did that. So they looked at the performance of people at one time. Then they changed the light, and then they looked again at the performance of the people. And they found that when they pull off the light and make it a little bit darker, performance increased. Then they were completely confused. Why that? Okay, now let's do the test. Let's increase in another shift, so to speak. Let's make it lighter. So they measured the performance and they lightened up the factory, and then performance again increased. So Can you imagine? You make it darker, performance increase. You make it lighter, performance increase. What's going on there? Yeah. The simple thing was that the people felt that they are observed. It was not the light. It was the simple fact that there were researchers running around measuring performance. And whenever you measure performance, and then people know that they are tracked, that they are measured, that they are part in a study, open observation, they changed their behavior. And this is what they did. So it was not the light. It was something else. So this pre-test, post-test design is a very poor design, really. And the same goes a little bit when you, but it's a little bit better when you have a repeated treatment design. This is something that you observe the dependent variable, then you do something, you observe the dependent variable again, then you do something, and then you observe the dependent variable again. So you have a constant treatment over again. You might do this with, you could also do this with retention measures. So you always track, you do something, track. So that's better. That's better. But still, you do not know whether over the course of this entire study, maybe there is something else that is changing, right? In that case, you have really just one group. You compare one group over a period of time, and every time you do something, afterwards you measure. Yeah, repeated treatment design. But you could also handle that differently. Maybe you have different groups. That's also something that you very often have in practice. You have three different groups. Group one, group two, group three. So, and in the companies, for instance, you'd sometimes simply have different shifts. So you have two shifts or three shifts. The morning shift, the afternoon shift, and the night shift. Yeah? And now let's say, okay, in one shift we do this, in the other shift we do this, and the other shift we do that. The light, give them different money, do different kind of methods of work. You want to check whether a specific leadership style has some effect on performance. So in the morning shift you do this leadership style, in the afternoon shift you do this leadership style, in the night shift you do this leadership style. Yeah, you just do different things. That's your experimental treatment. Yeah, the independent variable. Yeah, and then you look, okay, after a while, how things are, the dependent variable in morning shift, afternoon shift, night shift. And then you might see a difference. Okay, nice. But when you have this post-test only design, if you only have a post-test only design, you might not know how were things before you done your treatment. And you might not even know whether these different groups were different by nature. I mean, you might have a night shift and, okay, who is in the night shift? Maybe that's a voluntary thing and only those are in night shift who are young, maybe, who don't have families or whatever. Maybe there are specific types of personality that prefer a night shift. So it could be that in this different group, there are already, we call it selection effects, different types of people. You see this? So that can go on and on and on and on. And the true experimental design, that is different. You have an observation in the beginning, and you have an observation afterwards. So in the first stand, it just looks like a pre-test, post-test design. But you not only have one group, you have two groups. And that now, that already sounds like a real experiment. So what I want to share with you here is, very often you hear students saying, or amateurs saying, there was an experiment conducted. Or some would say, I'm doing an experiment. I can tell you very often you don't. You do don't. Because what is a real experiment? Let's look at this. And I would like to spend some minutes on this question. What is a real experiment? A real experiment is something that I've just have indicated to explain, indicated. Something where you have two groups. You have a measurement before the experiment treatment and after the experimental treatment. And a good example really is something that I already have mentioned. when you want to do test the effect of a pharmaceutical substance. Okay, so let's say this is a pharmaceutical substance that is good for I don't know, a chronic headache, yeah, something like this. Yeah. You could take everything, right? So this is a substance, and now you manipulate, I mean, that's clear, the independent variable. You do this by having some people who get the substance and some others don't. So that's the independent variable. The independent variable is whether or not you get this substance, right? This is what you do. So, and everything else is held constant. So the difference between these two groups is only the fact that the ones get the substance and the others don't. That's why we use a placebo, because it would not be okay if you just, the one group, the experimental group, gets a pill and the other group gets nothing. Why is that not okay? Because then there are two things between the groups. There are two differences between the groups. One group gets a pill and a substance, and the other group does not get a pill and no substance. And this getting a pill can already have an effect. Okay? And we know this. This is the placebo effect. Okay? And you always have this placebo effect. When people believe, oh, I get something that really helps. And they say, oh, yeah, my headache went down a bit. Okay, cool. Yeah, you probably believed in that. And those who are in the experimental group, who get the pill and the substance, they have both. They have the placebo effect because they believe in it, plus the real effect. Okay? It's a very interesting thing. Okay? So you have these two groups, experimental group and the control group. And the subjects, in that regard, patients, are assigned to these two groups randomly by just flipping a coin. That's absolutely important. Random assignment of subjects. I mean, it's also sometimes very hard to be done in practice, as I just have shown you with the different shifts. Also, I mean, sometimes we do studies here in the university, you know, as psychologists. Most studies in psychology were done with either rats or students. Rats or students. And for practical reasons, some might say, okay, let's have an experiment. And in one condition, we take the business students, and in the other condition, we take the technology students. Bad idea. Because once you get differences between the two different conditions, you will never know, is the difference because of the experimental treatment, the pill, the whatever you do, or is it because business students by nature are different than technology students in tech, right? And when you cannot ignore such a possible effect, then your experiment was not perfect. Okay, so here's a final thing that is quite funny. It's about the double blind. So when we go back to our idea of the pharmaceutical study, there is this person, this experimenter, yeah, who provides the pill or the placebo to real people, yeah, the patient. So it's a situation where you say, okay, Miss Meyer, here is your pill. In this moment, the experimenter should not know whether the pill he gives is the placebo or the real substance. The subject should not know anyway. Right? That wouldn't make no sense. That would be a blind design. But when the subject and the experimenter both do not know whether now this treatment happens as the, in the control group or in the experimental group, then it's a double blind. And this is what you want to have. Because what we know, and this is the so-called Rosenthal effect, goes back to a social psychologist called Rosenthal, who found that people can, in a very subliminal way, affect the behavior of others in a very unconscious way sometimes. Yeah. So in the case of the experimenter, it could be that the experimenter gives the pill to the patient, maybe knowing that now this is the substance. And the experimenter wants that this substance really shows an effect, and he or she might give this substance. So, Miss Meyer, here is the substance. Yeah. Here. And to the, maybe not so extreme, but for the placebo, he gives us a pill. So, Miss Meyer, here's your pill. Might not be so extreme, but you know, no, the experimenter should not know. That's double blind. Also, the observers in an experiment should not know. This is double blind. All those who are in touch with the subjects, all those who might interact with the subject, should better not know in which condition they operate, right? In order to keep everything constant, right? That's very important. We know this from some experiments of Rosenthal, said when experimenters have certain expectations, you will get what they expect. Right? I mean, we know this, for instance, we also name this the Pygmalion effect. We know this from studies done in schools. When you tell teachers, look, teachers, this time we have assigned the different students to different classes based on their intelligence. So this time we did not randomly assign the student to the different classes. We assigned the student based on the intelligence. Here's the, in group A are the dumb students, and group B, these are the smart students. Okay, now go ahead. If the teachers believe this, what will you get in the end? Indeed, those who are told to be smart will receive the better grades, while those who are perceived as dumb will receive worse grades, which makes no sense. It's just because the teacher have different expectations towards other students. They will treat them differently. They will look at their performance differently. They will judge their performance differently, and so the grades. That's very, you have to be very, very careful here. Okay? So I would like to leave it to that in the moment. What you take home for the moment is that there are different experimental designs, right? And there are different research designs, I have to be clear. And the first question you ask yourself when classifying your own design is whether you manipulate your independent variable or not. And then the rest, if you manipulate the independent variable, then the question is only, is it a real experiment or is it? And if it's not a real experiment, but you still manipulate your independent variable, then it's what we name a quasi-experiment, okay? And what you take home from this episode is that different experiments lead to different problems. And there is only one perfect way, which is the real experiment, which in practice is very hard to be done. So when you don't have a real experiment, you always have problems. You can never say that the independent variable affected the dependent variable. You never can say so. Okay? And that refers to an idea or to a concept that we name the internal validity. And internal validity describes to what extent you really can say that any change in the dependent variable goes back to a change of the independent variable. Okay? So I would like to have a separate episode in the next one where we talk only about this. I really want that you understand this. It's very important that you think these things through. it also takes a little bit away your naivety, I would say. It's very helpful. Okay, so that's for the moment, and we see us in the next episode.